Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Fireside Room, Jack Sage is speaking on early pioneers and settlers in Washington State. So let's listen in on Jack Sage.
I'm not a professional historian, but my family have been out here since 1843, and they came on the Oregon Trail, the first wagon train, which was had 1,000 people, and it had 120 wagons, 5,000 livestock besides the ones that were pulling the wagons. It took them 6 months to get out here. They left near St. Joseph, Missouri, late in May. Ordinarily, when they came after that, they usually try to leave around the 1st of May. They had to wait till late May because the weather was terrible, rainy. Also, when you across the prairie, you had to wait till the grass came up because you couldn't carry enough hay and grain for your livestock. And so they would wait till the grass got up high enough. Also, most of them used oxen because oxen grazed better than any other animal. Horses were little, didn't do a very good job. So they took several yoke of oxen. Now my ancestors that came out in 1843 came out with 9 children. The youngest one was 3 months old when they started. The oldest one was 20 years of age. They had 4 girls, I think it was, and the rest of them were boys, 5 boys. It was a long trip. The wagons, they had a big family. I'm sure that most of the older kids, which there were about 5 of them, 6 of them that could have walked. And I imagine they walked, because in spite of what they have in the movies, they did not ride in the wagons. Only the real elderly and the pregnant women, and quite often that wasn't until the very last, which spurred things on usually when they got on that wagon, because they had no springs. The wagon was the size 4x4 by about 12 foot long. They were lighter. They had little wider wheels for going across prairie and sand. They couldn't use it. Conestoga wagons, which are too heavy and too bulky, they would have worn out their livestock. They had to take their own milk cows so they'd have fresh milk for the children and for the men's coffee, things like that. They had to carry enough supplies to get them to at least some of the trading posts. Now, they had a trading post at Fort Laramie. They had another trading post at Fort Boise, and a few of the other spots where they could pick up a few supplies. The first wagon trains were luckier than the rest. The Indians were not suspicious of them as much, and so they were willing to trade they'd trade salmon and venison and other things with them. Also, the buffalo were still around, and so every day they'd send out a hunting party that would hunt buffalo, and one buffalo would feed quite a few people. Anyway, they got out to Oregon, and it's about October. Part of the way, this is the first wagon train to go all the way with wagons. Before that, they had to take and pack everything on pack animals or make a little two-wheel cart. Marcus Whitman met him about the middle of Missouri, and he says, "I can get you there." He says, "I know how to, we'll do it." He says, I've got carts through." And Marcus Whitman made quite a few trips. His first one was back in 1836, if I remember right, 2 years after Jason Lee went to Salem for the Methodist mission. Anyway, they had to cut timber. They crossed rivers back and forth. The wagon beds on these were also waterproof to some extent. So whenever they came to a river that wasn't too deep, they could float it across. However, at the start, they had the Kaw River, which is a Kansas river, about a week out. They had an Indian ferry. They had 2 canoes with a platform on, and they'd ferry the wagons across. It took them 2 or 3 days to get all those wagons across. With luck, my great-great-grandparents got their wagon on there and their kids, and it flipped. And they lost nearly all their household goods. The Indians jumped in, and they saved my great-grandmother, or great-great-grandmother, and all the kids. Like my great-great-grandmother, Sarah, hung onto the yoke of the wagon, and the wagon went drifting down and finally went ashore. and they saved her. So they didn't lose anybody. But for years, our family tradition been, well, they bought this upsetting of a wagon and so forth and almost drowning. And we thought it was just family talk. About 10 years ago, I looked in a book, history book, of Oregon and Washington, published in 1889. I think it was published in Portland, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I opened it up, and here was a picture of my great-great-grandmother, her second oldest daughter, and the son-in-law. Mm-hmm. Only picture I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And inside, there was a story about this wagon train coming, and also about the perils and so forth they had. Okay, I have some other people who have wagon train relatives, and would you like to add a little bit?
Well, my sister married into a family that the ancestors came over the trail. It was a little bit later, in 49, but they didn't seem to have much trouble, according to the diary that I've read. They did have a baby born when they got to Eastern Oregon, and they just stayed part of one day, and then they kept going. Like most of the others, they couldn't hold up because they had to get over the mountains before the snow came if they could. So they settled in the Milwaukee area first, and then they went over to the Beaverton area. And there's one little creek there in Beaverton called the Fano Creek. Well, they intermarried with this family, so there's a lot of the local history there in the Beaverton area of these two families.
I presume and I hope that you've been writing some of the things, information I have.
Well, we have, I found in the Hillsborough Library, they have some of the excerpts of in their, one of their old papers.
Maybe
they have made copies of.
You might find my grandfather. He was born in Hillsborough in 1861. Mm-hmm. One of the things about that...
Who is she? I mean, give us your name.
The name is Denny, that she's referring to. D-E-N-N-E-Y.
It's not the Seattle Denny's, though.
No, this is spelled with E-Y. And they always lived in the Portland and Beaverton area.
You drive around the area out there, Beaverton, there is a Denny Road.
Denny Road.
Across Fano Creek.
Those two have intermarried.
One of the good things about the wagon trains coming out, until that time, we had no women out here. The men would marry the Indians or Indian women or live with them. But, the men get kind of raunchy, I've heard, if they don't have a woman's touch once in a while. They had no schools to speak of. And the first one that was started in Oregon was, they called her Grandma Brown. She started... one in university, but it was a start in a grade school level, and she got up to a university, first university outside of Willamette.
Well, that's an interesting story, too. She didn't have any money.
No.
But in the finger of her glove, she found one little coin, and with that, she started, she bought some yarn, I guess, and started knitting mittens. And that's the way she founded a school, by selling the mittens. And then it turned out to be Pacific University afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Forest Grove,
Oregon.
Yeah.
But it was just a school for youngsters. I mean, kids that didn't have any parents at first.
Yeah, it was kind of an orphanage. They had the Sager girls there for a while.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. After the Whitman massacre, they massacred all the boys and the men. But the girls, they didn't. One of the girls did die. But the Sager girls were adopted out by different families, and supposedly religious families, but they treated them almost like slaves. And I've read some books afterwards that they wrote about the treatment they got from these families. That was a sad story. A woman in Dayton, a young woman, wrote a book called Seven from Oregon, or Seven to Oregon. And it's the story of the Sager children. And so I bought it, and I stopped in Dayton one time to look her up, to find out. And she had a wall way up here, just full of books of the Oregon Trail, of Whitman Mission, and so forth. And it's a lot of people are doing that, but that's why I hope you're writing some of this down. The reason I said that, 1986, I found out my Zachary family, who came out in the 1843 wagon train, I had nothing, no information until I started doing census records and looking in these old history books and so forth, and I found quite a bit. Then I found some old letters, and so I got enough information that I put out a little booklet. I sent it to Texas when they celebrated their 150th anniversary of statehood, because they were in Texas before they came to Missouri on the wagon train. And so they put this into the, they have a historical museum of pioneers. My ancestors were there when the Alamo fell. And they moved just from Arkansas across the line, just got into Texas when the Alamo fell. And they were in Texas for several years, and then they went to Missouri. And then it came out here. Now this is, you wonder why this, what this has to do with Washington history. At that time, though, the Oregon Territory included Washington, Idaho, parts of Montana, and parts of Wyoming. In 1843, we had no government in Oregon, and so they had to form a government. A man with a Ewing, Young, had a lot of property in Oregon, and no will, and they had no government to get rid of his estate. And so they formed a government, 1843, And that was the start of Oregon. 1853, Oregon became a state, and so the Washington Territory was on its own for 10 more years. They, at that time, then Oregon was out of it. Then Washington Territory was the largest territory in the United States at that time. It included all of Washington, all of Idaho, all of western Montana as far as the Rockies, and parts of the Wyoming, which included Yellowstone and the Tetons. It was a large area. The only military force they had was the small force at Walla Walla and the one at Fort Steilacoom. 1858, then they put one at Fort Simcoe, and so we had some military government. That was after the war with the Indians that took place 1855 to 1856. This changed the state of Washington quite a bit. The early pioneers had wagon roads going up to Spokane. They had a wagon road that ran from Walla Walla to Fort Colville, and they were using that. But the Indians, that wasn't the Nez Perce, the Palouse Indians, the Coeur d'Alenes, the Spokanes, didn't like it. They wanted tolls paid, and they wouldn't pay it, and so they killed quite a few. And so then the army was called in to put down the Indians. And the first one to do that was Colonel Steptoe. He went roaring up there with about 200 or 300 men, and he was going to get them all. Well, they had over 1,000. All the Indians, first time in a long time that they'd ever gotten together. They almost slaughtered him. He retreated, and he was saved only because one of the early converts of Spaulding brought him through a secret passage, or a passage that they knew, that the Nez Perce knew. Nez Perce Indians were friends of the white people. And the only time that they had that uprising is when they were forced onto a reservation, which was nothing like the beautiful area that they were from. It was a shame. And that was, of course, everybody knows about Chief Joseph's flight. Almost made it to Canada, moving women and children and everything, and stayed ahead of about 3 different armies until finally he gave up and says, I can't fight anymore, I want to find my children. Okay, this on the wagon train is just a build up to some of the other things that happened. The Mullen Road was surveyed by Army Lieutenant Mullen, and that was from 1858. We couldn't depend on wagons all the time, because in these areas, the roads are terrible. There was no way you could get on. I was raised in Eastern Washington, right where the Mullen Road and the Fort Colville, Fort Walla Walla was. And we were kids, I didn't know the history. You could go out along the road, you'd find wagon wheels, you'd find old guns and so forth. And being kids, we just played with them and lost them. But they were relics. And I didn't realize what hardships they were until we'd live there, and as kids, we'd take our wagons and go out into the scab rock, just like the pioneers, and rattlesnakes everywhere. And our folks, they never did know what we did. But, yeah. The next thing that we did, Incidentally, the title is A Study of the Arrival of Early Pioneers and Settlers in Various Areas of the State. And this will include a brief study of their origins and their ethnic backgrounds. And I want to get into ethnic backgrounds a little bit. The next thing, the wagon trains came until about 1869. And then the Union Pacific and Central Pacific got the railroad built to California. Everybody, the immigrants that came out, would go all the way to California, and then they could take a ship from San Francisco, and they could come up to the Northwest. And that was the way they were going. I had my Smith family went on a train about 1871 or 2 with all their children. They stayed in Monterey, California for about 3 years. They decided to go up to the Northwest, and they didn't have enough money for a boat fare. So they got some of their neighbors together, and they had to buy a four-wagon train. And they got up to Winlock, Washington, which is, you Washingtonians know just about where that is. They had to ferry across the Columbia River, and then they homesteaded at Winlock. And I don't know why they picked Winlock, except land was free there, evidently. And they were there for quite a few years, and then World War I came, and part of the family moved away. But that was one route. The railroad, Northern Pacific, was incorporated by Abraham Lincoln about 1860. And he chartered them, and he says, well, you can build a railroad. We need a northern route to the Northwest. And so they started surveying it. Mullen was one of the surveyors, and Isaac Stevens, one of our territorial governors, was commissioned. And so he did a survey all the way across into the Dakotas. By 1873, they'd reached the Dakotas. And then it was up to Colonel Custer to protect the surveyors and the railroad builders, because the Sioux Indians were attacking them every time they get out there. So, and he was, actually, that's what he was doing when he was finally annihilated in that little bighorn. Okay, the railroad on this end was different, the state of Washington. It was taking them a long time to get across all of Montana. It takes a long time to drive, let alone build a railroad. Those of you have driven, and it's not the most comfortable place to drive. They could not get enough laborers to work on the railroad, and so they used quite a few Indians, but they also used Chinese. And they imported a lot of Chinese from China to build the railroad. And so it took them quite a few years. They started also at the same time building the railroad from close to Longview. They used to ferry the railroad cars across the Columbia River from and Portland. You can imagine, there were huge ferries. They could have about four tracks side by side. They did that until finally they were able to build a bridge. But they built a railway from there to Tacoma. Everybody in Tacoma, Seattle, Olympia, Steilacoom even, were expecting the railroad to end up in their backyard, because having a railroad terminal in those days was the thing that you wanted. They didn't, the only one that got it was Tacoma. Seattle got mad and they built their own railroad. They built it from Seattle to, they got as far as Renton with it, to the coal mines at Renton, and then they got in an argument and they quit. But they did get coal out. The Northern Pacific got to Tacoma at the wrong time of the year, wrong period. 1873 was one of the severe depressions. I was reading in an old 1873 newspaper that the railroaders were on strike. They hadn't been paid for 6 weeks, and they refused to work. And so they went out and sold some timber, I guess, the railroad did, to pay the men off. And they finished the railroad into Tacoma. And that was the terminal for quite a few years. It was the terminal until even when I started in, after World War II. Railroad then, one of the things they did was encourage immigrants to come out to the Northwest. They had the railroad, now they needed passengers and freight. So what they did is they advertised in the European newspapers, we have free land for you. In fact, the railroad did give them the land. They even fixed home sites for them and everything else. Most of the people in Germany and Ireland thought that was a pretty good deal. And so they got on the Northern Pacific, and they came out. The biggest group we had was what they called German Russians. Catherine the Great, in the way back in the early days, told the Germans if they would German farmers if they'd come over and farm along the Volga River, their boys would not be drafted and they wouldn't have to pay taxes. So all the time that she was in power in Russia, they acknowledged that. But this, I think it was Nicholas was his name, the next czar, he needed some more cannon fodder, as he called it. And so he started drafting some of the Germans. And so they, as soon as they could, they left. And they came to America. And they first they came to Kansas. And they didn't like Kansas. It wasn't anything like where they'd been, for sure. And so they got one of these advertisements about Whitman County. A little competition here. Well, that's okay. He's just going by. Anyway, they advertised, and I had a copy of, there's a book put out by a man by the name of Sherman, who lives in Endicott, and he's on the school district. I think he's a school superintendent. He wrote a book on these German Russians.
I read the book.
Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting. See, there were Lutherans there, but they were such strict Lutherans. I hope I don't upset any Lutherans. But they were so strict that when they came to America, a lot of them became Congregationalists and Methodists. I think they even became a Baptist or two, Bill, I'm not sure. But anyway, they wanted something different. But eventually, a lot of the later ones started coming in. They were Lutherans, and they started small Lutheran churches all over eastern Washington. The farms are very small when they start out, but the soil is rich in the blues, and it was enough to support families in those days. And so they, all around the Palouse area, Colfax, St. John, Endicott, there's a lot of German Russian families. Eventually, the more that came, the less land there was available, so they moved a little bit more east. Now, those of you who know where Odessa, Washington is, that is another conclave of German Russians, and they are good farmers, and the best thing about them is that they have the Oktoberfest every year, and everybody from Western Washington, Eastern Washington, Canada comes to them, and the town's only about 1,500 people at the most.
It's this weekend.
It's this weekend, yeah. Yeah. Well, you're all ready to go, you two, aren't you? Yeah, I forgot about that.
The town grows from about 900 people to about 10,000.
Yeah. Day and night. They're also, like you were telling me the other day, that they're sports oriented. Small towns in Eastern Washington are, that's the whole thing. Is sports. I was in a little town of Sprague, which is even smaller than Odessa. And if I didn't play football, basketball, and baseball, they would have run me out of town. Because that is entertainment. Anyway, the German Russians are there. They also have quite a few down at Ritzville and down into Pasco and Tri-City area. They have a few down in there.
Quite a few in Walla Walla.
Yeah, in Walla Walla. And they... a lot of them are now raising peas and stuff instead of what they used to wheat. Anyway, this railroad advertised, and these people came out, and they had the land, and of course, then they started paying taxes, and then they started getting governments. And of course, they brought their families, and that was a thing. They had all country schools. I can remember when I started, was over in Eastern Washington, they had a little country school. They'd have eight grades in it, and there'd be only about eight kids at the most, six to eight kids. And the youngest ones learned from the bigger ones. And that the kids really got a pretty good education. Then during the Depression, we couldn't afford all those little schools, and so they consolidated them, and then they had to bring them into town. And so they had a little bit bigger districts. Now it's going the other way again. The towns are getting so small that several towns are going together to have their school system. Like Heartland, yeah, there's three little towns all together in order to have a team. Okay, now the some of the ethnic groups, other places, I've got a little bit of information about some of them. I already told you about the Germans and Russians. Well, Tsar was Alexander, that was his name. And he was—he caused them to leave about 1870 in three waves. First one was in 1870. Next one was between 1887 and 1893, and that was a bad time because 1893 was another depression that we had. We had depressions. Every time I go through history, we've had depressions about every 20 years. We had them in 53, 73, 93, and 1913, just before World War I. So we've had our share, but these poor immigrants came at the wrong time. And so they had to live with their families, other families. The last wave of them was about 1903 to 1913, and that was just before World War I. Those who came at that time were discriminated against very much so. I remember in all the towns, they called them Kaiser people and everything else. It was rough for the people at that time out here in the West. By 1920, they had 116,535 persons in the U.S. who had been born in Russia that were German citizens. And that's remarkable. I never always wondered why we call them German Russians, and now I know. I know that they're very good. They had, let me go back up here again. They had 116,500, by 1920, they had 116,535 persons in the United States who were born in Russia and considered German in their mother tongue. And that's a lot of people from one small area of Russia. They had the first arrivals out here in the Portland area in about 1881. They didn't find any ground that was fit for cultivation. They must have found what was left over at the rest of the homesteaders hadn't taken. And so they saw these advertisements of the agricultural lands in the Northwest, which was mostly in Washington. And it was available by 1882, a year after they got to Portland. And it would be available by the railroad, and so they took advantage of it. And I'm glad because they're good citizens and good taxpayers, and they raise wonderful crops. All of you been in the Palouse area? How many have not been in the Palouse area? I think you all have.
Palouse.
It's over by Pullman. It's got the greenest wheat that you'll and the peas. Now they have what they call rape, which is a seed that it looks like mustard, but it isn't. They use it to squeeze oil out for canola oil, which is made from rapeseed. I asked my relatives in Canada, that's where I first saw it, why do they call it canola oil? Well, it's originated in Canada and it's an oil. And that's why they call it canola oil. It's supposed to be
a more dignified name, some people think.
Yeah, do you think it's better than... I agree with you.
There are actually two kinds of rape. There's the kind that you can consume, and there's the other kind that's for industrial.
Yeah, a lot
you
of it...
You can't grow the two together.
No.
Anymore.
Yeah, you have to keep them separate. And up in Canada, they have a processing plant up near Saskatoon, and where some of my Canadian relatives are. And they were telling me about it. And I thought it was kind of funny. I didn't know that they ate the other, or they was fit for human consumption, the other. But the fields were a long ways apart. The good plants were upwind quite a ways from the others. So I don't think they'd get cross-pollinated. These primary Volga Germans, they settled in Endicott, St. John, Dusty, and Colfax. Now, those of you who have ever been to Dusty is well named. Mm-hmm. But they have some nice farms there, but Dusty is always Dusty.
Oh, there's a marvelous restaurant there.
Oh, yeah.
Go through the best pie in the world.
See, I knew I was going to get some input. that's a nice trip. That's the road that's fairly new. I have a daughter that works at Washington State University, and of course that was my school, and I don't speak to Huskies except on rare occasions, but I love to go through that farm because they have llamas grazing along there. They have all cattle. Once in a while, you get in a cattle drive, and you have to wait until some of them drive them with horses, but most of them use kind of jeeps or four-wheel drives.
How did they get to the name Palouse country? I've always thought that was...
That's after Indians. Palouse Indians.
Oh, I see.
And you've heard of the Appaloosie horses?
Yeah.
That they supposedly were bred by the Palouse Indians.
Oh, okay.
The Palouse Indians were a very good tribe of horsemen. And a lot of the farmers used to harm to... When I was over in Pullman, the Indian used to break horses for the farmers. He'd go, and that was his job. He'd go along and they'd only pay him, $3 or $4 to break a horse, but he would. But Indians were natural right. In our history that I had the other day, I forgot to mention, but we used to have dwarf horses in the state of Washington until the Ice Age came, and then they vanished. And then the Indians had no more horses until the Spaniards let them loose in the Southwest, and they eventually got up here. Sometimes they were brought up by ship, but that's how they developed into being horsemen. Okay, now we'll get into the Lutheran part. How many are Lutherans here? Oh, goody. I looked up Lutheran with a little bit of the history of it. And the churches in Palouse, and these were mostly from the Black Sea Germans, they had a German congregational church in 1883 in Endicott. Just south of Endicott is a Swiss colony. It's not anything related to the Swiss colony of wine or anything, but it's a colony of Swiss came over and they settled together just south of where the German Lutherans are. The German Lutheran Church was started in 1890, which is about 7 years after the Congregational. So they were starting to get some people falling out or some new ones coming in. They also had, Farmington had one called Christ Lutheran, and that was in 1896. Colfax had the Peace Lutheran, and that was started in 1902. And these are all just about the time that the drives or the waves of people were coming over. They came over and they... most of them that came late, I think, didn't want to give up the Lutheran religion. And so they were instigators of restarting the churches.
It was partly language, too.
Yes, it was.
We knew the pastor in Endicott. That was where Shelf was for a while.
Marlin.
I don't know. Marlin and Shelf.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Lind had quite a few, and I was there for 5 years. They had a congregational church. And up until about 1951, they spoke German in it entirely. Mm-hmm. Women sat on one side and the men on the other.
Oh, yeah. The two Lutheran churches in Wallowa both have German origins.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have much German anymore, but they started.
Jack, one of the things I came across, the Germans from Russia, like the men belong to lodges, and I don't know what they were, but when they came to this country, they found that the Lutheran Church frowned on that, as they did Masonic organizations and so on, and that's why a lot of the Germans from Russia joined the Congregational Church, which didn't have a problem with their men's lodges.
They let them do what they wanted, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was kind of the mark of the devil. A lot of them, you know, the lodges. You've probably, some of you have been to Roslyn, and there's 26 different cemeteries, and there's different lodges there. Nobody, one lodge wasn't going to be buried with it was somebody from another lodge or another another nationality, and so there's 26 different ones.
I have a very dear friend whose family was German, and they must have come at this time, and they settled in Deer Park and also in Tico, and they had a terrible time in school. It was during the First World War.
That's right, and they.
I don't know if they were German, Russian, not they were German.
If you had anything of German name or anything, you were frowned on. You were people were very bigoted during World War I. My ancestors or my relatives lived in Idaho. Of course, they're very strict, and a lot of I used to call them bigots. I guess I shouldn't, because my relatives that were there, part of them. But they see things a lot different than others. And anybody that came in that was a foreigner. Mm-hmm. Also in World War I, in 1914 and 17, immigration, of course, was curtailed to the United States with the Germans. And it was after the war, The revolution, then that discouraged a lot of them, the revolution in Russia. And so they were afraid. A lot of them were afraid to come to the United States. The other colonies that we had of Germans were in Adams County, where Lind and Connell, there's quite a few. They have a German, a Mennonite church just outside of, between Lind and Odessa. It's a small group, but they're well-to-do. They know how to farm. And they know how to, and they use good equipment. We also have a Hutterite colony. They came from Russia originally. Then they went into Canada, and then they're out there close to, between Ritzel and Lind they were, and I understand they've moved. There's a Hutterite colony in Canada who were, I was up there visiting one time, and I wore shorts and says, "Oh, you're American tourist." One of the fellows came up. He had a plaid shirt on, and I says, "Oh," he says, "I'm at the colony." And I said, "You can't be a Hutterite not with a plaid shirt." "Oh yeah, we're a little more liberal up here." We and they are. They allowed it, but they had the black pants, just like the others. They use the best farm machinery they can afford, but they have usually an old station wagon for transportation. And as soon as they can, they get their own teachers for the kids.
Yeah, and they speak German among themselves. At the Odessa Deutsches Fest, you see the women, and they're all wearing the same brown. They must buy one bowl of cloth.
Yeah. We visited the Hutterite colony over there.
Oh, yeah, you were on those bus trips?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And everybody wore the same thing. The women all had the same blouse on, the same material, the same dress. And the kids were taught young to sew. The girls took probably 3 years of sewing and learned how to sew to make the things. They made all their own clothes. They made the men's pants, and they made the men's shirts, made the kids' clothes, and everybody dressed the same.
Everybody takes care of their kids, too. And then even the women work in the fields and help out in the farm as well.
They work mighty hard.
Yes, they do. Did they offer you any wine or anything?
We had lunch with them.
Yeah, they usually have wine. They make their own wine.
We didn't have wine.
You did?
We had lunch with them.
Well, they must have known that you were a Methodist or something. But they are very—they're friendly people. But also, I felt so sorry for the kids. They went to school at Lynn for a while, because and the little kids, you know, they had to dress just the way that, and it kind of bothered the little kids because the others picked on them. The American kids picked on them. Okay, we had other waves of the Germans come over also after World War II. My neighborhood, I have about three German brides from World War II that they're good friends of mine. They're good cooks, but they have the best looking yards, and it puts mine to shame all the time. But they've been here, and they volunteer. I have a volunteer in my senior center where I volunteer. They always help. We have other ethnic groups. We have a lot of Dutch. You people know where the Dutch are in Washington?
Linden,
yeah. We also have some.
Oak Harbor.
Yeah, Oak Harbor. We have, Pell Valley has some. Nisqually Valley has some with the bulls. Also, we have a lot of Hispanics. I was born in Yakima, and we used to work. They had a few Hispanics that come up just to harvest. At that time, they had sugar beets, and they had to work in sugar beets was called stoop labor, and a lot of our whites would not work, and so the Hispanics would, cut the tops off of the sugar beets. They had a refinery at Topney, sugar refinery, and they had one at Moses Lake, and that's when the Hispanics started coming in, and then they started staying for the other crops. Now, I was in World War II. I got out in the winter of 1945 and 46. I had a job at Yakima, but no place to live. They have a farm labor camp out on Autan. It's about 7 miles from Yakima, and it's just a summer-only camp. They had little thin walls. They decided to be nice to we veterans who had a job. And so they says, "You can live in those cabins." So my family and two little kids stayed in a little one room that was smaller than my bedroom I have up in the chalet. It had a double bed, a crib for the youngest one and a dresser. And we had a card table we had to fold and unfold to eat. And two chairs, I think. No water. And a wood range. But we survived. They gave us lumber to line the inside of the, so we'd have another wall. Otherwise, we'd have just bare studs. We stayed in there, and they had some of these migratory workers got stranded. They had a storm. And so they always like to prune all the fruit trees around the valley there in the wintertime, because that's when they can get all the laborers. All these poor people were stuck there. They had no money. They had a little grocery store there that they put, it was a company store. They got a little bit of groceries on credit. And I don't think they could work enough to pay it off. It was a late winter, and they couldn't get out there to prune the trees. And I felt so sorry for them. We had a pet cat. We put stuff out on the stoop for the cat to eat when we put it out. And these kids would come over and get the dried bread or toast or whatever we had out on there. And that's when I realized I wasn't as poor as I thought. We also had a lot of Asians came. Now, we had Asians come way back. I mentioned the Chinese laborers for the railroad. They also, after the railroads were built, then they moved into central Washington, and they followed the gold fields. And they'd go along, they did the gleaning, what we would in the biblical sense would call. They'd follow wherever they were, and they'd pick up the little flakes of gold and stuff that the regular miners missed. Well, then they started competing with others for jobs. And so Seattle, Tacoma, and Portland put them on freight trains and sent them south, got rid of them. And that was, they gave them just a few minutes' notice. They didn't get much notice. They couldn't take anything with them. We had the same thing happen in World War II. Immediately after Pearl Harbor, I was over at Tacoma. They gathered up all the Japanese, even though they'd been here two or three generations, and sent them to internment camps. They lost all their farms, and they kind of backfired on us, because that's where we all got all our truck garden vegetables, was from the Japanese farm. And nobody was farming because all our men were in the service, and the women were working in the shipyards and the mowing. And so the produce industry really dropped right after that war, after World War II. We have our biggest population, immigrants, believe it or not, in the state of Washington, is Canadians. And that's our biggest group of immigrants. And I was, you know, I always thought maybe it was Asians or something else. But they are the biggest, and they have, I think I had the figures here. I have them here. Anyway, they are the largest group. The English are the next largest with 360,000. Well, of course, I figure that some of us probably are considering that group. And this is a 1980 census. Germans at that 1980 had 328,000. We have 138,000 Irish and 108,000 Norwegians. I thought we had more than that, because every other person I talked to is a Norwegian or a Swede. Over
the coast. They should make no secret.
No, I'm. That's true. We had we have 66,000 Swedes, 41,000 Italians. A lot of them are in the Tacoma area. And Seattle. Also, they had 35,000 Scots. And I know they had a few, but not that many.
Does that refer to non-naturalized people?
I think it referred to all of them, whether naturalized or not.
Are you talking about just Washington State?
Washington State.
Wow.
Who was the biggest group? I didn't get that.
Canadians. And then the English. Now, I think they consider. Now, I'm an English ancestor, so I suppose that's what they.
Well, is this country of birth, or tracing it back a couple of
years? I think it was country of birth. That's what they go by on the census records. It's where you're born. And this is what from the 1980 census. That's quite a diversity, but after that, we've got some more. Now, the Scandinavians mostly were loggers and fishermen. When they came from over in Scandinavian countries, they wanted to go locate where it was very similar. A lot of them came to Minnesota until they cut the timber, and then they just came west. Weyerhaeuser, he was one of the first ones to come out, and he made a deal with the Northern Pacific Railroad. They traded property, so Weyerhaeuser would have the biggest timberland in the state of Washington, next to the Northern Pacific Railroad at that time.
Was Weyerhaeuser what?
George the Weyerhaeuser? They were a timber company in
what nationality?
It was German.
German. Yeah, they were German.
Friedrich Weyerhaeuser.
And they, a lot of them are in Tacoma area yet, the descendants. Also, they were, besides being fishermen, they're boat builders. I have one that lives in my town of Stilton. It's one of the best, makes wooden boats, and you could, they're just perfect. There's none of, you can't see the seams in it. Polesville, of course, that's north. Ballard, good night, they've got enough left there. And Tacoma, Seattle, of course. I have relatives in every city in the state, I think. And some of them are characters. Yeah, I can't understand. I had one in Ballard who she lived on a houseboat in Lake Union, and she just got tired of it, and she had a parrot about 50, 60 years old, orangest thing I ever knew. And so she sold her house, and it was on a log raft, and so they hauled the house, dug it off up the hill, and then she moved into Ballard. And what a character she was. But two of her sisters were on the gold rush at the Yukon in 1897. One was married to a fellow who was going to go mining, but he was ended up running a hotel and a restaurant up in Dawson City for about 10 years. But another one, one of the great aunts was down to San Francisco when the fire came, and she lost all her property in 1906. And then the Indian Wars, I have the others that were 1855, the 1858, 1870. 1878, Nez Perce. I had them all involved, and they ran them out of a lot of towns, I imagine. The Yugoslavians, we have quite a few, and Gig Harbor is where we got quite a few. They also in Tacoma, Anacortes up north, and Edmonds. And I didn't realize Edmonds had so many. Latvians, we have a lot in Tacoma, and we can blame the Lutheran Church on this. After World War II, we had Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania were taken over, overrun. And so Lutheran Church sponsored young men. And so we hired three of them in my railroad, Northern Pacific, Latvians, good workers. And the last one just retired just a couple of years ago. But they were sponsored by the Lutheran Church. And why, I don't know. Unless they had Lutheran ancestors or relatives. We have Croatians. They're fighters. I have them on the railroad with me. And they were fighting each other when they weren't fighting somebody else.
Aren't there some cemeteries in Roslyn
that have Croatians? Yeah, the one that impressed me was the Druids. There's two little graves, Druids, from England, I guess. Hmm. Witches, yes. What's that?
You're talking about in Roslyn?
Yeah.
About that too.
Well, yeah. I think there is a lodge in this company called Druids.
Yeah, it was almost like a society.
Yeah, I think it's like Oddfellows or something like that. I think that accounts for that.
They used to, they used to go down to the Columbia River by Maryhill to the Stonehenge, and they'd have ceremonies. Around it, and they finally had to fence it off, I guess. But nobody wanted to be buried next to them because they're quite a ways away from the rest of the cemetery. They have a cemetery of blacks. There's 200 burials in it, and I think there's only about 6 markers. I took pictures of it because I'm interested in black history. And so I went in, I took pictures, and then I met one of the people who was there when in the 1890s, they had a big strike, and all these other nationalities wouldn't work in the coal mines, and so they imported several hundred blacks to work in the mines, and so they did. But a lot of them were killed, probably in barroom fights, and also killed in the mine cave-ins, coal mines in the known to be very safe. So there's 200 burials. I talked to some of the families that are there, and they're trying to find out where these people, where they're buried. You can't even see hardly where they're at. There's not stakes for a lot of them. It's kind of a shame. It's a big open field. And you see just a few little monuments. And the few monuments there, anybody else get into that, walk up into there?
Where's this
memory,
is it?
Roslyn. It's up, it's near nearly the top of the hill. As you come in, turn to the right and go up the hill. Mm-hmm. There's the old part of Roslyn is one side, and then this is an open area, and it has a sign, it's Mount Sinai, or Sinai or some cemetery, I forget the name of it. It has a nice, neat sign. The cemetery is well maintained, but most of the graves are raised about this height.
How new is it? I'm not sure which one.
It's.
You said that's the new cemetery?
Well, the new cemetery is down below. It has grass as you come in. But this is, you go by it. You turn right as you come in and go by it. And then you'll see, you go up slightly up in a hill, and you'll see an open space. And it looks like just a big field is all it is. But this is where they're all buried, and they've done an impossible job because a lot of them didn't read or write, and so when they went to work, I suppose they just gave them a number. I know that's the way the timekeepers used to do with the fellows that we hired off hobos and stuff that they used to hire.
Just give them a number.
Give them a number, and then the Social Security numbers that later. Okay, now we had Polish. Now we have quite a group of Polish people in Tacoma, and I like their food. They're very good cooks. We have, I told you about the Swiss Mennonites. We had those in also in the La Crosse, which is also down in the area. I don't know how come they let Norwegians in the German area, but they did down there in La Crosse. And you better not run over here. The Puget Sound area, when the Greeks and the Yugoslavians came out here, it reminded them of the Adriatic and the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. And so that's why they all settled in that area. I've noticed Italians, too. They used to be in the old town, part of the old hilltop area of Tacoma. That used to be all the immigrants would come in there. And they all had gardens, beautiful gardens. And I used to get invited. I had an Italian working for me, and he didn't. Every time I came to town, he'd invite me to eat with his folks. They take a bowl about this big of spaghetti and a salad and the Dago red wine, and I'd stay there half the night just to get rid of it. And it was good. It was the real Italian food. The Cascade Mountains reminded the people, the Swedes and the Norwegians, of their homeland. And so we had a lot of them up in the timber. We have a lot of them up in the, used to have them up at Leicester. And a lot of Italians up there also. That used to be the main line of the Northern Pacific Railroad. It's just outside of Auburn. It's about 30 miles up there, and it takes you an hour and a half to drive it. It's on the watershed road of Tacoma City Water, and it's also on Scott Timber's got the locked gates so you can't get in there. When I was a railroader, I had to do the testing of the signal apparatus, and so they'd let me in. And you go up there, and you had to dodge the elk, because there's no hunters allowed up there, because they don't want anything to get into the watershed. It kind of reminded me of Holden in the way it's a community all by itself was. There's one person living it now, and she was a postmistress, and she's so stubborn, she's not going to leave. She's almost 100, and she won't. The Western Washington countryside was so close to southern Germany, and that's why you had so many of the Germans moved in there. The Willapa Hills, now that's the other side of between the ocean and Puget Sound, the Willapa Hills, and that was, I wondered why we had so many Finns, but it reminded them of the forests in Finland. And so that's why they like, it's not as cold, naturally, as Finland, but it reminded them quite a bit because the hills are more rolling.
Town of
Basel
in particular.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had some Finns work for me on the railroad. They, one thing about Scandinavians, I never worked downwind from them because they all chewed snus. they call that the Swedish breakfast food or Norwegian breakfast food or Finnish food. It all depends who you were talking to. It was dangerous to work near them. Our last ethnic group that I want to talk about are, just briefly, are the blacks. Now, they have been neglected in history. We have two famous ones. Both are famous. One's George Washington, one's George Bush. They are the real George Bush and the real George Washington. George Bush came out here in 1845. He settled near Tumwater. He had a homestead close to the Olympia Airport. He was a Baptist, and a good Baptist because he gave from his heart. A lot of the immigrants that came out didn't have a thing to eat, didn't have anything to plant. He said, I'll give you the seed, but he says, instead of repaying me, the next person that comes in needs to repay them. And so he did, and he was well respected. Blacks were not allowed to own property in Oregon, so they came up here, and that's what George Bush and George Washington both did. They immediately came up north. The Washington State Territorial Legislature granted them the right to own land in the Washington Territory. Gave them special passed special legislation. George Washington founded the town of Centralia. He platted it, and he called it Centerville. He named the streets after different valuable gems because he thought that that was a gem. And he was another Baptist, I believe. They were both freed slaves, and they got their freedom before they came out on the early wagon trains. Washington came out in 1850. Bush came out on the 1845 wagon train. Well, the history of the black women also, they've been overlooked, and I'm going to discuss that when we get into the women, which is on Friday. I've got quite a bit of information on the women, and that's unusual. Usually when you're doing genealogy or anything else, you can't find out anything about women. The women have done more volunteer work, and they've worked in various families, and a lot of them have made money. We have some in Seattle who are well-to-do. We have two federal judges in Tacoma. One of them is Jack Tanner. He's semi-retired, and then another one took his place just recently. And so we have two black judges for federal government. Japanese and Americans are back. One of them was the mayor of Fife for many years, between Tacoma and Seattle, and I've known him for quite a few years. He has one of the largest greenhouses near Fife, as in his family. Oh, it's nice. I also have some information up here. You have to do like I do. I go to all these secondhand bookstores, and if I want to find out inexpensive books about Western Washington, I go over to Eastern Washington to the secondhand bookstores. And I come back with them. I did come back with a bunch of grass historian. This is a story about, this is Sherman, wrote some of the articles. It's about the German Russians, and it has a lot of names. I got this, and it was published in 1983. It cost me just $1. And it's 36 pages, and just full of information about the German Russians. And every so often, the newspapers will put out articles about, during our centennial, 1989, we had our centennial of the State of Washington Constitution. And so we had special articles. The News Tribune had, and I cut them out. A lot of it was on ethnics, a lot of it was on blacks, a lot of it was on pioneers. And so I cut them out and I put them in scrapbooks. And when I leave this earthly domain, my wife's going to have the biggest bonfire that you ever saw. Because I write journals. I've been writing a journal every night. I write 130 words at least a night. And I've been doing that for over 10 years. I've kept diaries. I've found all my old relatives' diaries, an 1893 diary of my great-grandfather who had... I didn't even know his name until just I found his diary. And he was in Brookings, South Dakota. Found out he was a Methodist. He wasn't all bad. And he was a very methodical. He was a church treasurer, and he was also he was a town councilman, evidently. He wrote down everything the church, all the giving. Everybody gave 15 cents, 20 cents. He wrote it down in this diary.